Hi, Craig Wilson here, and welcome to the Making the Media podcast. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us for more in-depth chat behind the scenes of the news and media business. Our guest for this episode is Duncan Hooper, who's the head of content for CGTN Europe, which is the English language news channel of China Global Television Network. Duncan is currently leading a newsroom integration project to ensure the organization's storytelling is optimized for all the platforms and audiences it serves. He also has a deep interest in the rise of generative AI and what this may mean for the media industry. We'll go on to discuss this in depth, but first I asked Duncan to talk more about his career background and current role.
I run output for CGTN Europe. We've been here in Chiswick Park serving the whole European zone since 2019, and we're one of four production hubs for CGTN, which is the English language international arm of the Chinese public broadcaster. I myself have a digital media background. I've actually worked in newspapers, newswires, magazines, and television, as well as a digital only publication. So I've done kind of all the different kinds of media that you can get. And now I'm working in television. And I think the thing that I'm bringing to this role is looking to converge a little bit the television output and what we do for social media and the website. Because what we're finding is the audiences are really diverging. We've got different audiences in different places. And therefore, what we're trying to achieve is to make sure that our best content is available to all of the different people that we're trying to serve in a format that they appreciate, engage with, and is easy for them to consume. So, you know, with the goal of trying to, you know, not having a particular focused target audience, we're trying to reach, you know, very general mass market audience. We feel that we need to be in all those different places, and we don't really want to be producing, you know, different types, different stories, if you like, different subjects for those different audiences. We want to be producing the subjects that we think, you know, talk to the reasons that we exist, but we want to be adapting them into formats that we think are appropriate.
What kind of challenges does that pose in terms of trying to bring the teams together? Because I guess it's a different mindset from thinking this is purely for television to thinking about this is actually for digital outlets as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the first challenge that you get is around just volume of work, right? Because if you go into any newsroom and ask, okay, how busy are you? Everybody will tell you they are very, very busy. You know, working on TV against, you know, the deadlines that you need to fulfill to get a show out is very high pressure. So finding the physical time space and not just the headspace to do digital work is difficult. But then, as you say, also there is a conceptual part to it. There is, and I think, to be honest, that is more achievable than many people think. Many of the people even that I work with who sort of are very wary about TikTok or about YouTube, and because they're not necessarily native to these platforms. But I think when you, if you can understand how these platforms work and the sort of the templates that exist on these platforms that are different, but if you like, similar in concept to the templates that you might use on television, you know, when people are very familiar with, you know, two ways and packages and lives. And if you can sort of break down social media into similar sort of formats, I think it is graspable for people. So you then have the challenge of creating the time. And I think a lot of that is actually about technical work to try and really simplify workflows and make it easy for people, for instance, to edit content, you know, at one time in different ways. And going forward, obviously, AI is going to be a big asset for us. And you have platforms already like Munch, which can take longer form video and already start to package it up for social media.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think a good story is a good story, regardless of which platform it's on. You know, the fundamentals are still remain the same. So you touched on the potential use of AI there, which is, I think, somewhere we'll discuss a little bit more. So where are the kind of applications you think where AI can be effective in helping news, content creators create content?
So there's obviously lots of different ways, and this is, you know, fairly well known. Here we are not creating any new content for publication using generative AI. That's not something that we're ready to do. It's not something I think that we would always rule out, but there are very well documented challenges around that. I think the areas where it is useful is, you know, especially around this packaging thing. So, for instance, being able to create social media headlines and posts to go with something that you might be producing on television, where you don't necessarily have journalists who are particularly comfortable doing that. And to be able to say to ChatGPT, you know, give me six options. And probably you're not going to use one of those six options, but you will probably use various ideas or concepts that it's thrown up. And I think that can be really helpful to provide inspiration. We have been experimenting a little bit with, as I mentioned, Munch and Opus, which allow us to take, you know, some of our longer form work where we do want to get out shorter clips, and we have found those pretty effective. The translation part is enormous for us. You know, that has just improved time and time again. And, you know, I looked at it when I worked at Euronews, we had 12 different language teams of human beings, and a lot of the work that many of them were doing was actually, you know, translating content, you know, line by line, and it was painful and it was expensive, and, you know, it wasn't really inspiring for them to do. And we looked then at auto translation, and we just found, look, it's throwing up too many errors. It's creating almost more work than it's saving. And I think that pivot point has been passed now, where, you know, using it is providing real value. So we don't do a lot of translation here. We do try and put some of our content into Chinese so that audiences back in China can see, you know, what's going on in Europe. And that does save us a huge amount of time.
Yeah, so it's that whole thing, I guess, around finding the right applications for it and the ways it actually benefits your business is the way to actually look at how it can be implemented. Because I think there is a whole thing at the moment about, you know, people are very interested in AI but can't really figure out the bits where it's actually going to make a difference. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously so many different options with it. And when we talk about AI, of course, remember it's just a huge field that encompasses millions of different things. But, you know, I have explored, you know, myself looking at AI presenting, and it's just not at all something that I think, you know, we are ready for. We looked a little bit at AI voicing, again, which is much more of a viable option already. We've decided for the moment not to use that, but actually I think potentially quite soon in the future that could save our journalists time. One of the things they do is, you know, when we've got sound bites in a foreign language, we need to go into the dubbing room, you know, dub those, take those dub clips, go and, you know, import them into our system, add them onto the edit, and you could really speed that up if you could use, you know, AI dubbing, especially because most of them are fairly short sound bites. So, you know, that is something that we are looking at, but again, don't quite feel comfortable doing it yet. So yeah, I think there's many different, you know, options for it, and we wouldn't use it to create scripts at all, I don't think. And that part of that is about having that trust that the work that you're seeing is done by journalists, because I see that there is going to be an intense competition arising, because although I say, you know, we're not going to use AI presenters, we're not going to use AI to write scripts, you know, other people will, whether those are new entrants to the market, because I think a lot of the established brands are very worried about damaging their brand by doing this, but for new entrants, there's a lot less to lose. And the potential for them to be able to create enormous amounts of content very cheaply is right there. And if that happens, how do we differentiate ourselves? Well, not having gone down that route is a point of differentiation for us. And to be able to say, no, you know, we are human beings. We are using editorial judgment and values, and we are not, you know, we are not prone to making the same kind of mistakes, or even, you know, following algorithms with biases that, you know, AI can do.
Yeah, I mean, in the last couple of days, I'm sure you've probably seen it as well, but, you know, I've seen stuff on across social media of an AI news channel with an AI presenter and, you know, generative AI images that are there. You talked there about the volume of content that could potentially be created by these kind of organizations. What concerns do you have about that? Because I think we'll come on to talk about distinctiveness, which I think is something you highlighted there. But do you have concerns just about, you know, potentially the news market being swamped by messages and information coming from sources, which then poses challenges for the audience trying to figure out, well, what is real and what's not?
Yeah, I have huge concerns about it. It's worrying to me as, you know, someone who makes their living in this industry, and it's also worrying for me as someone who values the media as important to our society. And you know, this it's not really new, right? We've had social media where suddenly the barriers to content creation have come down and down and down, and it has become possible for, you know, billions of people around the world to create their own content. And you know, we've seen that has posed amazing challenges around misinformation, you know, new challenges. And that has not really, we haven't really dealt with that problem already. And yet it's about to be magnified thousands, millions, billions of times by the fact that AI can do all this, but at just, you know, scales that don't require human intervention. And you know, that worries me a lot, because I, you know, I look at how social media companies have struggled to deal with, you know, relatively simple, I say simple, I don't mean simple as in it's easy, but the production methods are fairly simple in that you can, you know, get 100 people sitting around their computers and say, look, guys, I want you all to share this content and spread it, and you can create very simple kind of bot networks that will spread it. And I say simple again, it's not necessarily very easy, but it isn't a particularly complex system. And yet the social media platforms have been unable to deal with those. And I think largely for cost reasons. It's not revenue generative to stop this problem, given the high costs it poses. And therefore there's been not enough incentive to do it. And that's just going to get worse and worse. And you know, I think we rely on, you know, Google in the sense to protect us from this, and we've seen, you know, Google trying to do that by bringing all these trust metrics into its algorithms. But I'm skeptical about their ability to deal with very, very smart AI tools, and that means that, you know, the visibility of, you know, channels like mine, like many other channels, where, you know, there are very clear, you know, editorial standards, are going to drop, and it's going to be harder to find our material compared to material which is, you know, made by places whose provenance is uncertain.
Is there enough being done, or do you think this is something which regulation can actually influence? I mean, you know, the EU, for example, and others are looking at around regulation of AI, but they're probably not necessarily looking at the specifics that we're talking about.
I'm quite skeptical about whether a regulation can solve these problems, because it's a global problem, and we've seen that the world's not particularly good at coming together to solve problems. You know, we're faced with, you know, massive destruction of the human species, and we find it difficult to come to a, you know, a consensus on that, let alone, you know, dealing with this problem, which may not perhaps seem quite as life-threatening, although it, to be frank, it is extremely important to us as societies. So short answer, probably not, because you know, you could look at, say, okay, we want to punish the social media companies and we want to force them to do this, but the truth is that the cost of them doing that would be prohibitive for them. They've already shown that they prefer to pull out of markets rather than pay money that makes them, you know, unprofitable. So I think you would just see perhaps some of the more established ones retreat, and other ones would then come and take over that were maybe less, even less reputable and had less at stake. So I'm not sure regulation's the answer. I do think that the answer has to be around education and the media really selling itself, right? We have to do a better job ourselves of explaining why we are needed and why we are important. And we need to build direct relationships with consumers so that they come to us rather than going through intermediaries where, you know, that, as I say, that their interests and the interests of valid, accurate reporting aren't paramount and aren't at the front of mind.
Let's talk about distinctiveness then, Duncan. Let's talk about ways that, you know, perhaps that things can be done that can combat the kind of things that we're talking about. What do you think it is that journalists have to do really to highlight the value, I guess, in what role that they're playing within society? Because, you know, someone who was a journalist for a long time, you know, I see challenges coming because of the reduction in the importance of local newspapers, for example. And I think it goes the same thing there. 30 years ago, when I was joining, there was very strong local radio networks that also had distinctive news coverage as well. So let's talk about distinctive and how you think that can actually play a role in trying to combat this.
So, I mean, it's funny, we sort of come around in a circle, because one of the crucial things, I think, is that the media is using formats that is accessible to people, and we are presenting information in ways that fit around their lifestyles, because as we know, people's lifestyles have changed enormously, and yet the way that news is delivered maybe hasn't changed enough to keep pace with that. So I think if we want to be considered valuable to people, we need to think about, okay, how can we fit in with both the way they live and the needs they have. I am a big believer in the user needs model, and I do think, you know, as a newsroom, you have to think about what is useful for our audience, not just about, you know, what stories are we doing, but how are those stories going to be valuable to people in terms of meeting, you know, goals that they might have, and that those goals may be about, you know, feeling happy, they may be about learning something, they may be about being able to win an argument with their mates down the pub. So I think, you know, it's kind of cliche to say it, but I do think it's about being audience centric, both in terms of fitting the presentation of the content to the needs of the user, and also fitting the content itself and the way that you're dealing with subjects to those needs.
Is part of the problem the news agenda? Because the news agenda itself, dictated by a relatively small number of people, if we actually think about it, perhaps overly reliant on politics, perhaps overly reliant on issues that people perhaps don't see the value in. Do you think that's part of the challenge as well?
I've seen the studies, as I'm sure you have, about how turned off people can be by the sort of negative news agenda. And certainly, you know, that was my experience when I worked, you know, in newspapers, was always, you know, the bad news stories always made it, and you would never cover things where stuff seemed to be going well because it was perceived as not interesting. I think that has changed a little bit. I think that, you know, there is a much more of a willingness to look at solutions journalists and solution stories. Certainly that's something that I'm a great believer in. It's something that we try to do here at CGTN is to try not just to tell people about the problems in the world, which I think most people kind of are aware of, but encourage them that these problems can be fixed and try and talk about how these problems can be fixed, because I think people want to be inspired and excited rather than, you know, made afraid. I think that's a part of it. There isn't an easy answer, though, because if there was an easy answer, we wouldn't have a problem.
Yeah, very, very true. Do you think also part of the challenge is actually the audience themselves being more aware of, you know, the kind of challenges of things that are going on? Because I think one of the things that's happened recently, or in the last 10, 15 years, is that people consume news in different ways, and they perhaps don't necessarily recognise they're consuming news, and that they're not sitting down at 9 o'clock to watch the news on the TV, for example. They're seeing something that someone shared in a WhatsApp group, or they're seeing something that someone shared on a Facebook group. And do you think that's part of the challenge around people being more aware of where that information is coming from?
Yes, I do think that's part of the challenge, because people have been used to having these like bits of information presented. And, you know, it is something that we're conscious of. It is something that we, you know, we do, because when we produce content on TikTok, we're aware we can't always tell the full story in one minute video. So we are saying, okay, look, we're going to focus on telling a bit of this story, and we're going to assume that people maybe can fill themselves in on the other bits from elsewhere, or will fill themselves in. So yes, I think that is part of the challenge, and I kind of think it's good, though. I mean, I believe in pluralistic news consumption. I believe that it's healthy for people to gather information from different sources. I think the difficulty, though, like you say, is around the transparency of wherever those sources are coming from. And, you know, I think established news organizations, you do know, people know, for instance, you know, CGTN, we have China in our name, we have connections with China. People will know that the BBC has, you know, very much founded in a UK background. So these things are quite transparent and quite obvious. And, you know, isn't necessarily that transparent when you see just a content creator, which is, you know, generally the way many people are getting their news now, just from individuals, what forces are influencing them, how they are being funded, what they are, what agendas they might have. But, you know, how do you fix that? That's quite a difficult one. Again, and it sort of goes beyond the power of media to address that. So I think what media just need to do is to be able to, A, as I say, meet those needs, and then B, just be very clear and transparent about what they are doing in their work and why that work is valuable. I mean, I love some of the work around verification that, you know, a number of different organizations do, where they are showing their workings and they are saying, look, this is how we know this. You know, I think sourcing is so important for media like ours to say, okay, you know, not just what do we know, but how do we know this? Where did it come from? And you know, we do try and do that all the time here and put what both sides are saying and say to people, look, essentially you can make your own judgment as to what this means. But yeah, as I said, it's not, I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I think what we will try and do is we will try and straightforward as we can and let people treat people as grown-ups, but try and give them facts and information and not opinion and speculation.
Yeah, another element and something that, again, I've seen in the last couple of weeks is around the use of branded content, where people are creating their own content and distributing it because they can be in control of the message around that. And to you and me, that's not journalism. It's certainly not journalism as I would view it. But again, that's something else that I guess plays into this whole thing around trust, around authenticity, around, you know, where is the information coming from? So do you see branded content again as another element of this?
Yeah, I mean, again, it comes back so much to the commercials and the business models, which really, you know, drive a lot of the decision making. I mentioned it talking about how, you know, the way that social media tackles misinformation, I think, is so heavily driven by the costs involved in that. And I think, you know, the branded content side as well, it is about, you know, what content can you monetize? How are you going to pay for what you are doing? And often that means you've got to have somebody, you know, backing you. There's two ways. Either the person who's consuming the content is paying, or the person who's providing the content is paying. And, you know, I like subscription models. You know, we're very lucky here at CGTN. I don't have to worry about that. You know, we don't have any kind of commercial objectives or targets. And, you know, we're very straight about that. But, you know, I think if in commercial organizations where you do need to make revenue, I think that having a subscription model or some kind of audience pays model is the best way, because it takes away that, if you like, conflict of interest, where someone else is paying for the content.
We've seen, you know, an enormous rise in emphasis about AI in the last year, you know, I think driven by, you know, ChatGPT and the way things have gone with that. And then, you know, we've seen, you know, various different developments that have happened through the course of the year. So crystal ball time, Duncan, 6 months to a year's time, what do you think is the next thing we're going to be talking about in this? Or do you think it's going to be a continuation of where we've been for the last 8 or 9 months this year?
So whether it's in 6 months or 9 months, I'm not sure. But something that I have been very interested in for a long time is self-driving cars. Right? These things are coming. We know they're coming. They're starting to be here already. And this just, for me, provides the first kind of big opportunity for media that we've had for a while, where we're going to open up leisure time for people. Time when people sitting behind the wheel, you know, traditionally the only option is to listen. Okay, so podcast, radio, whatever, suddenly is potentially going to be opened up to video and reading and other forms of consumption. So, you know, for me, that's a, you know, in-car entertainment, because of the amount of time that people around the world do spend in their cars, and will continue to do so, whether it's electric cars or petrol cars. I think that's quite an exciting opportunity for innovation. And I, you know, I'd love to be thinking about how do we use that space. And the other one is, of course, VR.
where we've seen the headsets getting cheaper, getting less cumbersome. You know, the kind of glasses approach that you can get now is quite compelling compared with having to put on an enormous helmet, which, you know, realistically people sitting on, you know, the subway or waiting in the doctor's surgery are not going to do. But with, you know, with small glasses, you suddenly have a screen, which, you know, for a long time we've been dealing with smaller and smaller screens, right? We've gone, you know, from big computers to laptops to tablets to mobile phones. Okay, some of the mobile phones these days are quite big, but it's nothing compared to this screen. And yet when you move into VR, suddenly you have a screen which is as big as your field of vision, which again, I think is a very interesting challenge to, you know, where do media companies fit into that? You know, do you have a TV in the corner of your room like you used to do, where, you know, whether you're doing something else, you can hear and just turn and watch it when it interests you? Is that a part of the mix, or how does media and entertainment fit into that world? I'm excited about.
Yeah, that's great to hear that there's opportunities as well as the difficulties that we've perhaps discussed as well. So Duncan, there's a final question which I ask everyone in the podcast since day one. So I'll ask you, which is, what is it, if anything, that keeps you up at night?
So the funding model of the media industry is what worries me, because as I say, it's not such an issue with my work here, but so many places that I've worked, a lot of my job has been how do we cut costs and, you know, dealing with telling people they don't have any jobs anymore. And, you know, that's been an issue since the rise of the internet, you know, and this huge division of where advertising revenue is going. And as we've mentioned, you know, I think AI has the potential to make that many, many times worse. And, you know, a poorly funded media industry is a poor media industry. And I think that's very sad, again, for my, you know, personal, selfish, professional reasons and for my thoughts, for my colleagues, but also for the society we work in and live in, which I think needs a vibrant and a strong media industry that can afford to invest in journalism. So, you know, that's what worries me now. It's what's been worrying me for the last few years. And I guess it will still be worrying me in a few more years, time too, if I'm honest.
Thanks to Duncan for sharing his thoughts on what is undoubtedly a major topic, which we'll be discussing throughout the rest of this podcast season and beyond. What do you think? Let us know in the comments on the podcast episode, and don't forget to rate and review us there too, plus subscribe to get notified when the next episode is out. Check out the show notes to discover links to a recent episode with the BBC journalist Roz Atkins, where he sets out how to write and present clearly and how he uses these skills to articulate his stories. And you can also find there a link to a series of videos showing some time-saving features of Avid Media Central to enable team collaboration, regardless of the platform you're producing for. That's all for now. Thanks to our producer Matt Diggs. Thanks to you for listening, and thanks again to Duncan for being such a great guest. My name is Craig Wilson. Join us soon for another episode with the people making the media.